What's interesting about the call, and the dozens of others like it I made that day, is that long before any of these people knew me, many of them had been on one of many lists I'd been keeping for years. It was Sandy who eventually recruited me to Yaya. It didn't hurt that one of the other investors with a stake in the company, Knowledge Universe, was backed by the famed financier Michael Milken, who ultimately became a mentor of mine whom I'd met through a mutual non-profit interest. In November 2000, the Yaya board named me CEO and handed me two goals: establish a viable business model and either find a major investor or sell the company to a well-heeled strategic acquirer. At the time, Yaya had the technology to invent online games that corporations could use to attract and educate their customers, but the company had no customers or revenue. First, I sat down and established 90-day, 1-year, and 3-year goals in my relationship action plan. Each goal required me to connect with and develop different parts of my network. In 90 days, I had to establish credibility with the board, gain the trust of my employees, and set a clear direction for the business. In a year, I wanted to have enough blue chip accounts to be close to profitability and moving toward making the company attractive for potential acquisition. Most important, I had to prove to the outside world that Yaya was producing something worthwhile. The concept of advergaming, which wasn't even a word then, was not considered a viable segment of the advertising market. Interactive ads were hopelessly ineffective, and banner ads on websites were considered an industry joke. We had to differentiate ourselves. I wanted a business model in place 3 years down the road that could function without me, gain liquidity for my investors, and solidify the company's standing as a thought leader in the online marketing arena. To make these goals possible, I mapped out the most important players in both the online and games industries, from CEOs and journalists to programmers and academics. My goal was to get to know almost all of them within a year. To create excitement around our product, I wrote down a list of people I called influentials, the early adopters, journalists, and industry analysts that helped spread the initial buzz about a product or service. Next, I made a list of potential customers, potential acquirers, and people who might be interested in funding us down the road. In creating your own categories, each should correspond to your own goals. When you make lists, it's important you name the actual decision-makers and not just an organization. The point here is to have a readily accessible and specific list of names. At the outset, concentrate on the people who are already part of your existing network. I bet you have no idea how vast and widespread it really is. Take the time to list people such as relatives, friends of relatives, all your spouse's relatives and contacts, current colleagues, members of professional and social organizations, current and former customers and clients, parents of your children's friends, neighbors past and present, people you went to school with, people you've worked with in the past, people in your religious congregation, former teachers and employers. People you socialize with. People who provide services to you. People with whom you interact on Facebook. Other online connections in social media or community groups. Next, I enter the gathered names into a database. To note, LinkedIn now lets you aggregate contacts, whether they're LinkedIn members or not, and then see your communications with them across all major platforms. Very useful. I then create call sheets by region, listing the people I know and those I want to know. A variety of contact aggregators make it easy to sort your lists. When I'm in a given town, I'll try to phone as many people as I can. I carry these lists around with me wherever I go. They focus my efforts in cabs between meetings. I have something palpable to encourage me to reach out. If paper's not for you, you can do the same thing with any number of mobile apps. Some of the lists you create will be related to your action plans. Others are more general, helping you to stay connected. The way you organize your lists can be fluid. I have lists by geographical location, by industry, by activity. Other runners, for instance, or people who like to go out on the town. Whether they're an acquaintance or friend, and so on. Adding to the names on your lists is simply a matter of looking in the right place. In the beginning stages at Yaya, I read all the trade magazines having to do with advertising and games. If I read about someone who fell into one of my categories, I'd put him on a list and find out his contact information. When you're looking for people to reach out to, you'll find them everywhere. One great resource for making lists is, it almost sounds absurd, other people's lists. Newspapers and magazines do rankings of this sort all the time. Long before I became one of Crane's 40 under 40, for example, I had been ripping out that list for years. I clip out lists of top CEOs, most admired marketers, the nation's most progressive entrepreneurs. All of these kinds of lists are published in local and national publications. Every industry has something similar. You want not only to know who the players in your field are, but eventually to be recognized as one of those players. The people who are on Crane's 40 under 40 aren't necessarily the 40 best business people. They are, however, probably the 40 most connected, and they probably all have lunched with one another at one time or another. When you get to know these people, and the people they know, including the journalists at Crane's responsible for the 40 under 40, you're that much more likely to be on the list yourself the next time it appears. As you add names to your lists, don't worry right away about whether or not you can immediately connect to them. Mapping the landscape is where you start. The Internet allows you to do incredibly granular searches through millions of contacts, but you still need to know how to narrow it down. Media continue to provide one filter. Outside of that, LinkedIn is invaluable. A young friend complained to me the other day that the site hadn't helped him with his job search. He thought the to-do about it was all hype. So I asked him how he was using it. Oh, I sent dozens of resumes out through the job board and connected with some recruiters, but nothing came of it. My friend was missing the true genius of LinkedIn. The ability to comprehensively map not just your network, but the networks of entire industries. You've got to take the long view. Search its more than 200 million users by any keyword you can think of. Every profile you visit displays people similar to contact, and a handy map of that person's network that you can sort by company, region, and so on. And the site immediately tells you whether you share connections with any given person. It's the holy grail of networking. If you haven't recently taken time to connect to people on LinkedIn, mark down 2 hours on your calendar this week to send out personalized invites to as many people in your network as you have time for. You'll be surprised at how many new conversations you can start by making a simple LinkedIn request. There's another category you might want to add, something I call my aspirational contacts. There are those extremely high-level people who have nothing to do with my business at hand, but are just, well, interesting, or successful, or both. The people on that list may be anyone from heads of state and media moguls to artists and actors, to people others speak highly of. I list these people, too. If you could see my address book, I could show you the contact information for Richard Branson, chairman of the Virgin Empire. Now, I don't know Richard Branson yet, but I want to. If you scroll down a bit farther, you'll find Howard Stringer, CEO of Sony Corp of America. He was on my aspirational list once. I now know Howard. People get a chuckle out of this, but the results speak for themselves. Remember, if you're organized, focused, and a stickler for taking names, there's no one that's out of reach. As for me, my 3 years at Yaya came to a close. In 2002, Forbes magazine reported on our extraordinary rise to success as a startup that had come from nowhere with a totally new concept. The concept of advergaming gained a cultural currency in the marketplace, and the term is now used by CEOs and journalists alike. The other day I overheard a CEO, who didn't know we had created the word, bragging about the innovative tool called advergaming that had led to a measurable increase in the sales and recognition of his product. As planned, Yaya was ultimately sold to a public company, giving investors access to the liquid currency they were looking for and giving Yaya the operating capital it needed. And it's clear that without that bunch of lists to thank, Yaya would never have made it beyond the first year of operations. Chapter 9. Warming the Cold Call. Cold calls turn even the most competent of souls into neurotic messes. I can relate to those who go catatonic at the very idea of calling a stranger. So how do you manage a cold call? First, it's all about attitude. Your attitude. You're never going to be completely ready to meet new people. There is no perfect moment. Your fears will never be completely quieted, because inviting rejection is never going to be appealing. There are always 100 reasons to procrastinate. The trick is to just plunge right in. Remember, if you don't believe you're going to get what you want from the call, you probably won't. So in the words of Caddyshack, be the ball. You have to envision yourself winning to win. You have to view getting to know new people as a challenge and an opportunity. The very idea should spark your competitive fires, silencing the wallflower in all of us that shies away from socially adventuresome behavior. And second, cold calls are for suckers. I don't call cold, ever. I've created strategies that ensure every call I make is a warm one. Let me give you an example. Jeff Arnold, founder of WebMD, is a friend. Years ago, he bought out the rights and patents for a technology that put digital content on a miniature DVD disc for a unique delivery. Today, of course, it's completely obsolete, but at the time, it was an innovative new way to get digital content into people's hands. In talking with Jeff and his partner, Thomas Tull, I was told about the deal they had just closed with a movie theater company to distribute these DVDs on beverages sold at theaters. Jeff and Thomas thought that, given the demographics of moviegoers, a company like Sony Electronics could stand to benefit from this new distribution technology. But they didn't know whom to contact at Sony, and came to me for thoughts. I had met Sir Howard Stringer, CEO of Sony, a number of times, so I put a call into his office. But instead of just waiting for Howard to get back to me, I wanted to find a few other paths as well. At the time, I couldn't think of anyone else within my network of contacts who could hook me up with the right decision-maker within Sony. When no one responded to my phone calls or emails, I researched which agencies service Sony, and I found that BrandBuzz, a marketing agency within advertising giant Young & Rubicam, counted Sony as one of its top clients. Furthermore, the person who was CEO of BrandBuzz at the time, John Partilla, is a close friend of mine. So I called him. "Hey, John, I've got two things for you. One, I want you to meet a buddy of mine named Jeff Arnold. He's brilliant and creative, and you should know him. He's the guy who founded WebMD, and he started a new company, Convex Group, which may need your services down the line. And two, Convex is putting out this incredible technology that distributes digital content in a new way. I think Sony would appreciate being aware of it." In a sense, by reaching out in this way, I was offering John two opportunities: a chance to know someone of importance and interest, perhaps for new business, through Jeff, and a chance to look good with the business he already had, Sony, by bringing them new opportunities. John was happy to make the connection. He knew the perfect guy, the new head of media and internet strategies at Sony, Serge Del Grosso. I asked John to send a brief introductory email ahead of my call and CC me in the process. By having him copy me on the email in all subsequent correspondence to Serge, I could include John and put some urgency behind our meeting. Tacitly, as a result, both John and I were now waiting for a meeting with Serge. As with so many business dealings, that alone didn't do the deed. Serge was busy, and I heard nothing back from him or his administrative assistant after several emails. This isn't unusual. Frequently, people won't get back to you. You have to put your ego aside and persist in calling or writing. And when you do finally connect, don't sabotage your efforts by expressing how annoyed you are that they didn't get back to you as quickly as you would have liked. Nor should you apologize for your persistence. Just dive in as if you caught him on the first call. Make it comfortable for everyone. Setting up such meetings takes time. It is up to you to take the initiative. Sometimes you have to be aggressive. After a few weeks of no reply, I called Sony Information and eventually got Serge's direct line. When I call someone directly whom I haven't spoken with before, I try to call at an unusual time. Someone who is busy is more likely to pick up their own phone at 8 a.m. or 6:30 p.m. Plus, they're probably less stressed out since they're not facing typical 9-to-5 pressures. I called in the early morning but got Serge's voicemail. So I left a message saying, "I just want to reiterate my excitement regarding our meeting. I've never heard John talk so flatteringly of a business associate. I understand how busy you must be. I haven't heard from your administrative assistant, but I'm sure I will. See you soon." At no point do you want your interactions to become strained. Creating and maintaining a sense of optimism and gentle pressure around the appointment is all part of the dance. When I still didn't hear from his office, I called Serge's direct line after hours, around 6 p.m. This time, Serge picked up the phone himself, and I gave him the pitch. "Hi, Serge. It's Keith Ferrazzi. John's talked highly of you for some time, and I finally got a nice excuse to give you a call. I'm calling for my friend Jeff Arnold, the founder of WebMD, who has a new, very powerful way to distribute digital content. With some of the new products you'll be launching this quarter, it could make for a perfect partnership. I'll be in New York next week. Let's get together. Or if getting together this trip isn't convenient, I'll make room in my schedule for whenever it's more convenient for you." In 15 seconds, I use my four rules for what I call warm calling. 1. Convey credibility by mentioning a familiar person or institution. In this case, John, Jeff, and WebMD. 2. State your value proposition. Jeff's new product would help Serge sell his new products. 3. Impart urgency and convenience by being prepared to do whatever it takes, whenever it takes, to meet the other person on his or her own terms. 4. Be prepared to offer a compromise that secures a definite follow-up at a minimum. The result? I was in Serge's office the next week. And while his budgets didn't allow a short-term application, he totally understood the power of the medium for his audience. In retrospect, who knows? Maybe he had a better read on the future of technology. Good call, Serge. Here are some of the rules I follow, fleshed out in more detail. 1. Draft off a reference. The reason a cold call feels like torture was set out in vivid detail 50 or so years ago in an advertisement recalled by Harvey McKay in his book Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive. It pictures a corporate killjoy facing the reader who is cast in the role of the salesman. The killjoy says, "I don't know who you are. I don't know your company. I don't know what your company stands for. I don't know your company's customers. I don't know your company's products. I don't know your company's reputation. Now, what was it you wanted to sell me?" You can see the total lack of credibility one has when making a cold call. Credibility is the first thing you want to establish in any interaction, and ultimately, no one will buy from you unless you establish trust. Having a mutual friend or even acquaintance will immediately make you stand out from the other anonymous individuals vying for a piece of someone's time. What do I mean by that? If you were calling on behalf of the president, I guarantee you Mr. Killjoy on the other end of the line will listen to what you have to say. Drafting off the brands of others, whether personal references or organizations, is a helpful tactic for getting past someone's initial reluctance. Most of us, however, don't work for Microsoft or know the president of the organization we're trying to reach out to. Our task, then, is to tap our network of friends, family, clients, neighbors, classmates, associates, and church members to find a path back to the person we're trying to reach. When you mention someone both of you have in common, all of a sudden the person you're calling has an obligation not only to you, but also to the friend or associate you just mentioned. Today, finding a line into someone's office is a lot easier than when I started out. Again, Google and the major social platforms are nearly invaluable in this process. LinkedIn will immediately show you who you have in common. Do a name search, and you'll likely find where a person went to school, what his or her interests are, and what boards he or she sits on. You'll get a perspective on the person's life that should give you ideas on where a mutual contact might be found. What sports do they play? What nonprofits do they care about? Do you know other people involved in similar causes? People used to say there are only 6 degrees of separation between anyone in the world. A 2011 study of 720 million Facebook users determined the true magic number to be 4.74. LinkedIn's system is built on 3 degrees of separation. Whichever way you slice it, we're all only a couple of mouse clicks away. 2. State your value. Acquiring a reference or institution to draft off of is only a starting point. It will help you get your foot in the door. Once you have someone's commitment to hear you out for 30 seconds, you'll need to be prepared to deliver a high-value proposition. You've got very little time to articulate why that person should not try to get off the phone as quickly as possible. Remember, it's all about them. What can you do for them? When researching a connection to the people you want to meet, first do some reconnaissance about the company and industry they're selling in. Selling is, reduced to its essence, solving another person's problems. And you can only do that when you know what those problems are. When I finally got a chance to talk with Serge, for instance, I already knew he was preparing to launch some new products in the upcoming quarter. And in the busy holiday season, he was going to need something that would really stand out. I also knew his target audience aligned well with those going to the theaters. I can cut through the clutter of other cold calls by personalizing my call with specific information that shows I'm interested enough in their success to have done some homework. 3. Talk a little, say a lot. Make it quick, convenient, and definitive. You want to impart both a sense of urgency and a sense of convenience. Instead of closing with, "We should get together sometime soon," I like to finalize with something like, "I'm going to be in town next week. How about lunch on Tuesday? I know this is going to be important for both of us, so I'll make time, no matter what." You will, of course, need to provide enough information about your value proposition to make the person want to spend some time talking. But also, don't talk too much. If you launch into a long sales pitch without finding out the other person's thoughts, you can turn them off immediately. It is a dialogue, not a scripted monologue. Even my 15-second intro above left time for the casual, uh-huh, yes, or hmm, from the other person. Don't ever talk at someone. Give them time to come along with you. Remember, in most instances, the sole objective of the cold call is ultimately to get an appointment where you can discuss the proposition in more detail, not to close the sale. In my experience, deals like friendships are made only one-to-one, face-to-face. Take as little time as possible in your cold call to ensure that the next time you speak to them, it's in their office, or better yet, over some linguine and wine. 4. Offer a compromise. In any informal negotiation, you go big at the outset, leaving room for compromise and the ability to ratchet down for an easier close. I close my pitch with Serge suggesting that even if he didn't want to hear anything about digital content, I'd love to get together with him, just to meet, given our mutual friends' admiration and respect. Robert B. Cialdini's book, The Psychology of Persuasion, shows how compromise is a powerful force in human relations. An example used to illustrate this idea concerns Boy Scouts, who are often turned down initially when trying to sell raffle tickets. It has been statistically shown, however, that when the scout then offers candy bars instead, a less costly item, customers will buy the candy even if they don't really want it. In giving in to the concession, people feel as if they're holding up their social obligation to others. So remember, try for a lot. It will help you settle for what it is you really need. 5. Warming it up virtually. Nowadays, it's often the cold email, isn't it? I know plenty of people who try to avoid the phone entirely, and especially to interact with someone new. They tell you it's more efficient. Of course it's not really. They just think it is, because wasting time on email is already built into their workflow. My soapbox aside, the first rule of new interactions is to meet someone on their terms, wherever they're most likely to listen. If they want email, you give them email. Here's what you need to know beyond the rules I've already laid out to get responses from warm emails. Live and die by your subject line. If you don't, your email may never get read. Focus on your strongest hook, either the contact you have in common or the specific value you have to offer. Make them curious. Game the timing. There's a lot of debate about the best time to email, but I personally like to fire away when I think the person is apt to be spending time on emailing. Their morning, lunchtime, and the last hours of the workday are typical. Be brief. Once you've written a draft, the best version of it is usually 50% shorter. Yes, we're half as interesting as we think. Your email should fit into a single screen. If I have to scroll to get to the point, I've already lost interest. Have a clear call to action. What do you want them to do? Make your first request clear and easy. Request 15 minutes on the phone, not just a vague phone call. Offer suggested dates and times, not just a meeting sometime. Short-circuit the process as much as you can, and don't make them guess what you're looking for. Read it out loud. I had an assistant who would do this with every email she wrote, and it always made me laugh when I caught her in the act. But she was smart. Listening to herself, she ensured that the language was clear and conversational. And she timed it, too, with a 45-second limit. Spell check. There's no excuse for poor spelling and grammar in an email. I've written two books and have a URL with my name in it, and I still get people emailing Keith Ferrazzi with one R. I know you'll do better. Chapter 10. Managing the Gatekeeper Artfully. Let's face it, having a list of names of people you want to reach in business and a plan for what to say to them when you've got them on the phone doesn't mean much if you never get them on the phone. Half the difficulty in reaching out to others is actually reaching someone at all. It's even more difficult when that somebody is a big kahuna with a thicket of protective voicemail boxes, blind email addresses, and defensive assistants running interference. So, how do you open the door? First, make the gatekeeper an ally rather than an adversary, and never, ever get on his or her bad side. Many executive assistants are their boss's minority partners. Don't think of them as secretaries or as assistants. In fact, they are associates and lifelines. Every time I have ever tried to go head-to-head with an administrative assistant, I've lost. It's like that childhood game, rock, paper, scissors. Well, in this game, as Mary Abdo taught me, the associate trumps all. Mary was the assistant to Pat Licato, then the CEO of Deloitte. And in the beginning, we got along great. I remember once finishing up a dinner with Pat and Mary. Mary had to leave early, so I walked her outside while she got a taxi. The next day, I called to say thanks for arranging such a wonderful evening. Apparently, people rarely called Mary to thank her for organizing events, and she was very grateful. She even bragged the next morning to Pat about how much she liked me. Mary was a blast, fun and full of energy and wonderful stories. In my early days at Deloitte, when I'd call Pat, I'd spend an extra few minutes kibitzing. Mary, you're a hoot to talk to. Looking back, my relationship with Mary was clearly one of the most important reasons I was given such easy access to Pat, and my relationship with Pat was one of the most important relationships of my business life. However, with Mary and me, there was a time when all that began to change. I had just become chief marketing officer. At that time, I got my very own full-time administrative assistant, who I'll call Jennifer. I thought Jennifer was everything I'd want in an assistant. Smart, organized, efficient. We got along great. The only problem was, she didn't get along with Mary at all. Mary managed all the administrative assistants in our executive suite. Almost immediately, Jennifer and Mary were butting heads. Jennifer was digging in her heels and not letting up. I just thought they'd work it out eventually. "It's all a power play. She's wasting my time," Jennifer complained. I wanted to be supportive. Jennifer's complaints and concerns seemed reasonable to me, but I was hearing only one side of the story. I encouraged Jennifer to work harder at the relationship. And one day, after I had been pulled into the middle of another bout between them, I asked Mary if she could just work harder to get along with Jennifer. Mary didn't take my suggestion well. Before long, getting on Pat's calendar became more and more difficult. Bypassing corporate bureaucracy, which was a breeze in the past, now became impossible. My expense accounts were being micro-scrutinized, taking up my time, and the pressure on Jennifer was greater than ever, which made her react even worse. I'd had enough. I went up to Pat's office and said bluntly, "Look, Mary, this has to stop." If I thought Mary had been upset before, yikes! It was nothing compared to her ire now. Office life became a nightmare for a period of time. Finally, Pat drew me aside. "Keith," he said, "you've gone about this all wrong. Now this whole ordeal is making my life difficult. Think about it. I get to hear all this from Mary's side as well, about your administrative assistant. And I don't really want to have to deal with this. Second of all, you're being stupid. Mary likes you, and always has. Do yourself a favor. Do me a favor. Whatever it takes, smooth things over with Mary. When it comes to these issues, she runs this place." Personally, I had always cared for and respected Mary, but now I learned something else. An assistant like Mary has enormous power. Secretaries and assistants are more than just helpful associates to their bosses. If they're any good, they become trusted friends, advocates, and integral parts of their professional and even personal lives. One day, Jennifer, who was as loyal to me as Mary was to Pat, came to me and offered to resign. "Listen, I'm miserable, and your career is going to be jeopardized if all this doesn't get straightened out," she told me. It was an amazingly gracious gesture, as well as a way to restore sanity to her life. I promised to help find Jennifer another job, which she did quickly, and we remain good friends to this day. When I went to hire my next assistant, I did two things. First, I asked if Mary would pre-screen all candidates and rank her top choices. I went with her first choice. I also told my new administrative assistant to do whatever Mary instructed. It didn't take long for me to make up with Mary either. Pat was right. Mary did like me, and I just had to better understand her role. Pat started getting my messages again, and all of our lives were so much easier. As important as gatekeepers are within an organization, they're that much more important when you're working from the outside. At about the same time, Kent Blossel, an advertising sales representative for Newsweek, was one of 20 ad salespeople banging on my door looking to make a sale. But I had a media buyer at the agency whom we paid to take those meetings for me, and as a rule, I never met with ad sales reps. Kent was different. He knew the kind of influence a gatekeeper wields. Kent would call Jennifer once a week. He was deferential and overwhelmingly kind. Every so often he would surprise her with a box of chocolates or flowers or something. Still, despite my assistant's suggestions, I saw no reason to take the meeting. Jennifer persisted, however, and Kent must have been scheduled into my calendar on 10 different occasions without my knowledge. Each time I'd cancel. But she'd just keep plugging her good friend into my schedule because she felt he was different and had a more innovative approach than the others. "Have him go meet with my buyer," I finally said one day. "No," You're going to meet with him. You can take 5 minutes out of your day. He's very nice and creative and worth 5 minutes. So I relented. Kent certainly was nice. But he also came to the meeting prepared with a deep understanding of my business and an interesting value proposition. At our meeting, almost the first thing out of his mouth was, "If it's okay with you, I would like to introduce you to the top 3 senior editors of Newsweek. Would you be interested in that?" As someone who relied on getting the media to cover Deloitte's intellectual property, this was an important offer. "Of course," I told him. "By the way, we're having a conference in Palm Springs where some other CMOs are getting together with our editors and reporters. It's going to be a really good conference about media strategies and the new economy. Can I put you on the guest list?" He was offering a real business value, as many of the other CMOs would also be Deloitte customers. It would be a personal networking opportunity among my peers. "Yeah, I'd like to go to that. Also, I know your media guy has been evaluating a proposal we put in a few months ago. I'm not going to waste your time with the details. I just want you to know that it would be great if we could do business together sometime." That was it. That was Ken's 5-minute sales pitch. It was 98% value add for me, 2% sales pitch by him. I called our media guy after Ken left my office. "Go to Newsweek," I told him. "Quote them a fair price relative to the other magazines we were considering and give them our business in this segment. Make it work." And you know that when Ken went to another magazine, so did my business. My point? Always respect the gatekeeper's power. Treat them with the dignity they deserve. If you do, doors will open for you to even the most powerful decision makers. What does it mean to treat them with dignity? Acknowledge their help. Thank them by phone. Flowers. A note. And yes, there are times, of course, when the situation calls for more than niceties and pleasant gifts. At times, you'll need to use street smarts to get a meeting. Last summer, I met a former Disney executive on a flight to New York. In the course of our conversation, I mentioned that I was a fairly new transplant to Los Angeles, and I was always looking to meet good, smart people. She suggested that I might like to get to know an up-and-coming executive by the name of Michael Johnson, the president of Walt Disney International. There wasn't anything obvious that Johnson could do for my company or me at that point, but I felt he was someone I should meet. I was running a computer games company, and who could say whether Disney might someday be interested in the video game space? The only problem was getting through Johnson's gatekeeper. At a huge company like Disney, that's often a big problem. I called Michael Johnson when I got home from my travels and, unsurprisingly, got a neutral to cold reception. "I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson is traveling, and he'll be gone all month," his administrative assistant told me. "That's okay," I replied. "Why don't you tell him a friend of Jane Pemberton's called? Please tell him to call me back when he gets a chance." With the first call, you don't want to come off as aggressive. Remember, you never, ever want to anger the gatekeeper. My second call was more of the same, establishing my presence and making it known I wouldn't go away. "Hi, this is Keith Ferrazzi. I'm just calling back because I haven't heard from Michael." Here again, without being too pushy, you begin to create the presumption that his return call is imminent and expected. Johnson's gatekeeper politely took down my message and thanked me for calling. I asked for his email address. but she wouldn't give it to me, stating privacy concerns. On the third attempt, she was less polite. "Listen," she told me with a little edge in her voice, "Mr. Johnson is very busy, and I don't know who you are." Now I could either match her tone, and this would spiral downward, or... "Oh, I'm really sorry. I'm a personal friend of a friend of his. I just moved into the city, and Jane suggested that I should meet Michael. And honestly, I don't even know why, besides the fact that Jane is a good friend of Michael's. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's all wrong. Maybe Michael doesn't know Jane well, and he wouldn't want to meet me. I apologize if this is the case." By being so candid and even vulnerable, I put the assistant on alert. She now fears that perhaps she's been too gruff, perhaps inappropriate, to a friend of her boss. After all, I'm just a guy following a friend's advice. Most likely she'll back off, worried that she's closed the gate too tight. Then I made a suggestion. "Why don't I just send Michael an email?" And at this point she's thinking, "I want to be out of the middle of this thing." So finally, I got his email address. The email I sent was simple. "Dear Michael, I'm a friend of Jane's, and she suggested I talk with you. Jane thinks we should know each other." If I had something specific to discuss, I would have put it right up front. But the best value proposition I had was the mutual friend who felt this would be a win-win. It's sometimes effective to utilize several forms of communication when trying to reach an important new contact. An email, letter, fax, or postcard often has a better chance of landing directly in the hands of the person you're trying to reach. Johnson's reply was cordial and short. "When convenient, I'd be happy to meet." So I went back to his assistant with the information that Michael said he'd be happy to meet, and that I was now calling to find out when. And finally, we did in fact meet. Situations that call for this amount of maneuvering are unfortunately not rare. It's real work, and it takes a finesse that only practice can master. But once you recognize the importance of gatekeepers and turn them into allies with respect, humor, and compassion, there will be few gates that aren't open to you. Chapter 11. Never Eat Alone. The dynamics of a network are similar to those of a would-be celebrity in Hollywood. Invisibility is a fate far worse than failure. It means that you should always be reaching out to others, over breakfast, lunch, whatever. It means that if one meeting happens to go sour, you have 6 other engagements lined up just like it the rest of the week. In building a network, remember, above all, never, ever disappear. Keep your social and conference and event calendar full. As an up-and-comer, you must work hard to remain visible and active among your ever-budding network of friends and contacts. Let me give you an example of what I mean. A few years back, I got the opportunity to travel with then-First Lady Hillary Clinton on a C-130 troop carrier, crisscrossing the Southwest from one political event to another. She was up at 5 in the morning for breakfast and phone calls back to the East Coast. She gave at least 4 or 5 speeches, attended a few cocktail parties, where she constantly reached out to scores of individuals, and visited several people's homes. She must have touched 2,000 hands that day alone. At the end of the night, when most of our entourage struggled to get back on Air Force One, she huddled her staff, sat up cross-legged, and began to joke and chit-chat with them about all that happened that day. An hour or so of frivolity, and Mrs. Clinton moved on to scheduling the next day. No matter what your politics, you have to respect that kind of determination and sheer work ethic. I was shocked by the number of individuals she remembered by name along the trip. I was having a tough enough time remembering everyone's name in our group. I see examples of this kind of persistence and determination everywhere. My particular heroes, because of my background, are those people who came from humble origins. A fellow CEO friend came from a blue-collar family in the Midwest. His father, like mine, was a laborer for 40-odd years. He'll tell you he isn't the smartest guy in the room. He doesn't have the Ivy League pedigree of his colleagues, and he hasn't climbed the greasy pole by getting a boost from his family. But today he is one of the most respected CEOs in his industry. His formula is not complicated, but it is rigorous. He talks to at least 50 people each day. He spends hours a week walking his company plant, talking to employees up and down the ladder. If you send an email to him or his assistant, you can be sure there will be a response within hours. He attributes his success to the blue-collar work ethic and sensibilities he was raised with by his father. About his more starched white-collar colleagues, he once told me that while he had learned what these people know, they would never have an opportunity to learn what he knew. Now, you have to work hard to be successful at reaching out to others, but that doesn't mean you have to work long. There is a difference. Some people think building a network requires 18-hour days slogging through meetings and phone calls. If I'm slogging, or it even feels like slogging, I'm not doing my job, at least not well. Or perhaps I'm in the wrong job. Building a network of friends and colleagues is about building relationships and friendships. It should be fun, not time-consuming. When your network is set, your goals written down, you'll find plenty of hours during the day to do what needs to be done. How do I meet everyone I want to meet during the course of a week? Someone once remarked cynically, I'd have to clone myself to take all the meetings you take. You're on to something, I responded. I don't clone myself. I clone the event. Here's what I mean. A few months ago, I flew into New York for a 2-day business stint. There were a number of people I wanted to see. An old client and friend of mine who was the former president of LEGO and was now trying to figure out what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. The COO of Broadway Video, with whom I wanted to discuss a new branded entertainment TV show for one of my clients, and a close friend that I hadn't seen in too long. I had 2 days, 3 people I wanted to see, and only 1 available time slot to see them all. How do you manage a situation like this? I cloned the dinner and invited all of them to join me. Each would benefit from knowing the others, and I'd be able to catch up with all of them and perhaps even get some creative input about the new TV show. My friend, who has a fantastic sense of humor, would enjoy the group and add a little levity to what might have been just a stodgy business meeting. I asked my friend to join me a half hour in advance at the hotel I was staying at for a little one-on-one time. And if the details of the project I was discussing with the COO were private, I might schedule a little one-on-one time with him after dinner. The point is, I'm constantly looking to include others in whatever I'm doing. It's good for them, good for me, and good for everyone to broaden their circle of friends. Sometimes I'll take potential employees for a workout and conduct the interview over a run. As a makeshift staff meeting, I'll occasionally ask a few employees to share a car ride with me to the airport. I figure out ways to as much as triple my active working day through such multitasking. And in the process, I'm connecting people from different parts of my community. The more new connections you establish, the more opportunities you'll have to make even more new connections. As Robert Metcalf, the inventor of